So, James, in this podcast, we're going to be talking about death. And is death a laughing matter? And for me, yes, it is. And that's the end of the debate. So, on to the podcast.
No, I'm joking. We might need a bit more than that, I reckon.
Do you think we need to go into it in a bit more detail? Well, we've got this thing called gallows humour, which, you know, everyone's going to be familiar with. We've got, you know, it's jokes or humorous remarks that are made about unpleasant or worrying subjects such as death and illness. That's the definition of it, which I just read out. And that's literally what it is. But why? Why do we have it? Why do we laugh at horrible things like death? I don't really know the answer, but for me, you know, death is inevitable. It happens to everyone. We may as well confront it. You know, and one of the best lenses for examining unpleasant or difficult things is humor. So why not laugh at death? Because it's, you know, it's coming for us anyway. And, you know, lots of people have said this sort of thing. Let's have a laugh about it. It's the best approach. So for me, that's, you know, that's the premise. And my next wafer thin, bordering on pathetic justification for this podcast is that we're not just talking about people's deaths, whether they're amusing or not, you know, in a mean-spirited and nasty way. We're not just doing that. We're celebrating their lives and their careers. And generally, this is about people that have not only passed beyond this veil of tears, but they've also passed out of the public conscience, haven't they? So, you know, we're focusing on people that have passed at least 10 years ago or more. So hopefully the wounds aren't too fresh when we start picking over their demise for our own amusement. What do you think?
I think it's a very credible kind of half justification.
Yeah, it's paper thin, isn't it?
It is paper thin for a suggestion of a program rather than a program. But, you know, we like to soldier on. I think the other thing you did mention, which is really important, is that there's a ready supply of stories because, you know, people are dying every day, aren't they? So, you know, I wanted to look at the positives of this. I wanted to kind of focus on some of the, you know, some of the bright elements rather than the gloom because, you know, putting it together, you know, there's just thousands. I mean, it's almost too much to cope with. People perhaps should pace themselves a bit.
We're bringing a spotlight onto many great entertainers and other sort of public lives that have generally long since disappeared. And what entertainer surely would begrudge a fresh audience the opportunity to enjoy some of their stories and to squeeze a few more final laughs, purely at the expense of their dignity and possibly ours?
I think that's right. I think and the kind of I'm going to use the word cadre because I don't really know what it means, but I'm going to use it anyway. The kind of kudos that we're going to add to some of these lives of the rich and famous, and in fact the deaths of the rich and famous, I don't think, you know, that they would have anticipated that in their lifetime, and certainly I don't think their families would have anticipated any of it either. And we hope, really, with sort of cross fingers, that they don't get in touch.
Indeed, that would probably be the ideal outcome. My final thought on this sort of introductory framework and legal disclaimer is that, you know, ultimately all creative works are a matter of taste. And like former Monty Python star Graham Chapman, anything for us except mindless good taste. So for me, if as a listener, if you decide that after, you know, a couple of hundred hours listening to these podcasts that it's just not for you, then that's absolutely fine. You know, please feel free to accost someone in the newsagents and complain to them. But it is, however, mandatory to like and subscribe.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the old adage of it's got a switch that people of a certain generation used to say, I think you should bear that in mind. Though, of course, online, there's no switch, is there? There's just the kind of pause or a delete button. But let's not ponder on things that people can actively do because we want a passive audience who let these facts and not fictions, because these are real people that we're talking about, real lives, let them just wash over you. So shall we start by dusting off the portfolio and looking in a very respectful way at our first obituary for the podcast?
Let's go for it. Okay, James, here we go with my first offering. This is the life and death of an entertainer born in Kent in 1935. An English comedian, TV star, children's entertainer, commonly found on TV in the 70s and 80s, known for his flamboyant suits, often a top hat, and of course, best known for an arm puppet. Have you any idea where I'm going with this?
An arm puppet. I've got a couple of ideas. I guess I'd probably get closer if I could identify the puppet. So maybe you could give me a couple of clues. Was it sort of an anthropomorphic animal? Maybe a bird, I'm thinking?
Yes, you'd be right in thinking that.
Okay, and a bright green bird with a nappy on, I'm thinking?
No.
Oh, well, that must, we must lean into another direction then. I'm thinking metallic pink trousers.
I'm not sure where you're going with that. Let me put you out of your misery before we drive everybody crazy. The arm puppet was called Emu, which was rather aggressive and mischievous, if not outright violent, bordering on homicidal. And the comedian, of course, was Rodney Stephen Hull, known as Rod Hull.
Yes. And I'm not sure really, was it a puppet or was it just a sort of fantasy for some tendencies that he was trying to suppress?
It was an arm puppet. He put his arm up the neck of Emu and used his hand to operate the Emu's mouth, and he had a fake arm over the outside of the bird to pass off the effect.
It was quite convincing as well, I seem to remember, from the TV appearances I saw. You know, a lot of people did suspect it was a real Emu.
I think most people had a pretty shrewd idea it was a puppet, James. But we'll come on to that, actually, because there are some aspects of what Rod Hull and Emu did which attracted quite a lot of attention in different ways. The popular TV shows that that we probably as children would have seen Rod Hull and Emu on included Emu's All-Life Pink Windmill Show, which I remember, 1984 to 86, Emu's Wide World and Emu TV, all variations on the same sort of theme. And quick quiz for you. Rod Hull and Emu were the subjects of at least two pop songs. Can you name for 100 points each either of the two pop songs featuring Rod Hull and or Emu?
Wow, that's a niche trivia question there, isn't it? Normally I'd be quite good at because I'm pretty niche. Mind. I'm going to struggle with this one.
You won't get them.
I was thinking Bird on a Wire by Leonard Cohen, maybe.
That's a good effort. I know this is specifically naming. One of them names Rod Hull and the other one names Emu. You won't get it. I'll put you out of your misery. The first one, in chronological order, Rod Hull is Alive, Why? By Half Man, Half Biscuit, released in 1987. And an unrelated follow-up, No One Knew the Real Emu by the Toy Dolls in 2004.
And what do they sound like? Have you had a sort of perusal of those beforehand or not?
No idea. I've never heard of them. That's the pop trivia aspect out of the way. So what do you remember about Rod Hull?
I think people remember his demise, don't they? We're probably going to come on to the circumstances surrounding that.
We will come on to that, yeah.
I remember a very confused, drop-jawed gentleman with wiry hair who I think used to like sort of metallic clothing, sort of suits made out of bright, glittery material, I guess to distract people from the fact that the Emu maybe wasn't as real as it could have been. I do remember the pink windmill very well, and I remember grot bags and croc, and I remember there's somebody at the door, you know, those kind of
indeed
things.
Yeah.
And in fact, recently I've been able to kind of manage that memory and put it into a safe space within my mind, really. I guess the only other thing I really remember about him is him physically assaulting Michael Parkinson.
Indeed, he famously appeared on Parkinson's chat show and assaulted Michael Parkinson, or the Emu did. And Billy Connolly was also a guest, and Connolly famously also said to him that if you come near me, I'll break its neck and your arm, or words to that effect. I can't remember the exact quote, something like that. I haven't done too much research. I think that's it. I remember the TV show really well. I remember it very, very well. It was kind of a top children's TV show, and Grot Bags was absolutely brilliant, you know, a sort of green-painted witch who was kind of the villain of the piece, but she was very, very amusing, and she had these hopeless henchmen, a crocodile and a robot. What was the robot called?
That's a very good question. I think he might have just been called Robot or something. I don't know. Metal Leslie, maybe, or something like that.
It's a good guess. I really should have looked that up before asking that question. I don't know the answer. I seem to remember he was pretty camp, but that wasn't unusual for TV in the 80s.
I'm not sure if you're allowed to say that the pink windmill was camp, you know, really. That suggestion, I don't think, ever entered my mind.
Do you know, that had never occurred to me until now. I think it's back to the therapist for you, James. But Rod Hull actually had a TV career in Australia before he kind of got big in the UK. And he was kind of, as I understand it, he was kind of reticent about talking about Emu all the time. And he felt that he could have done other things. And maybe Emu in the end held him back. And it was a bit of a kind of a love-hate thing. But it absolutely defined his career in the popular consciousness, didn't it? But I think a point of balance is that there were allegations of there being something of a dark side to the act, and there were some accusations of inappropriate behaviour by Rod using Emu, and at least two people have gone on record to say that he behaved inappropriately whilst wearing Emu. I'll leave you to research that for yourself if you want to. Please check out Wikipedia and a 2017 article on the Chortle website entitled "You'd Never Get Away With It Today." Make of that what you will. What do you think about that?
I think I was slightly shocked, but I do remember something in one of the tabloid papers at the time about a series of heavy pecking events that I think went on in the green room. But I guess, well, you know, again, it comes back to how convincing his sidekick was, really. I guess a lot of people would have tried to prosecute the puppet rather than the man. And again, that leads, I suppose, to that fundamental question, doesn't it? Can you ever separate the dummy from the puppet?
That's a good question, actually. There's a very interesting psychological angle to this, and it goes right back to, you know, the wearing of masks and as you say, the separation of a performer from a prop or a tool or an extension of themselves, and whether the extent to which that representation, that extra thing, becomes something, you know, with its own will, or, you know, if it sublimates or channels desires of the other person which they can't express through their normal method. And it's a really interesting area of research, I imagine, having done absolutely none of it. I guess it can lead down some pretty creepy lines of inquiry.
There's a very good film I remember, which Tony Hopkins made when he was, I call him Tony because he's a personal friend, obviously.
He's a big mate of yours.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. He made very early on in his career, I think it's called Magic, where he plays a ventriloquist, and the dummy sort of slowly takes over his life and, you know, sort of makes him commit murder. And it becomes a little bit like Chucky, I think, towards the end, you know, that kind of thing. But it taps into some of those loosely based studies that you've just recalled, which I think you probably, was it Reader's Digest? Was that the main source for that kind of thing?
There's a huge literature in the huge medical literature and psychological literature about mask wearing and use of puppets and things like that. But as I say, it's all pretty creepy stuff. So not the best sort of thing for Sunday tea time. Do you think we ought to now move on to talking about the circumstances of Rod's death?
Let's talk about the demise, because I think a lot of people are probably aware of some of the key aspects of it. But I think, knowing you, I think it needs someone with your gravitas to handle it sensitively and to sort of guide us through the very difficult points in what happened.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, it's quite a significant kind of event. And when you say Rod Hull, I think as you suggest, people do readily start to pull back memories of something amiss. And you know, it's not a coincidence I've chosen this for my first discussion of the way someone went. 17th of March, 1999. Rod was watching a football match at home. He went up onto the roof of his house to adjust the TV aerial. Bit of an old school thing to do these days, but people used to do that sort of thing. I mean, baldly, in terms of the facts, he fell off the roof. There are some reports of him falling off the roof and also through or into a greenhouse. I don't know the exact circumstances there. He suffered severe injuries and was pronounced dead on arrival at hospital, and the East Sussex coroner subsequently recorded a verdict of accidental death. It was described in the press at the time as a bizarre but tragic accident. So the facts are pretty grim. You know, it's an extremely nasty way to go, unfortunately, and it's very, very sad. But my first question for you, James, is what is it about the circumstances of Rod's death that does hint at something funny happening?
I think for me, it's probably, I always wonder what the neighbours were thinking at the time. You know, were they thinking, oh, he's working on one of his routines again? Is he trying to make the aerial a little bit like the windmill? Has somebody finally caught up with him, you know, and his wandering emu? I think that there's I hate to say it, and again, it comes back to this sort of legal disclaimer stroke context setter that you gave us at the start, is that there's a kind of comedic slapstick routine built into his death.
I agree with you, and it's an extremely nasty way to go, and very sad. And I don't, you know, in a very real and legally meaningful sense, you know, we're not sort of laughing at that. But there is something, there is an aspect to it which I'm interested in exploring, which, you know, I think slapstick is the right word. You know, it's almost, I mean, his act itself was quite violent. It was quite aggressive. You know, he used to use emu to, you know, put his hand around people's throats and all, you know, it was quite a physical act. And there's it just sort of, you know, there's kind of a connection back to that in the way he fell off the roof and died. I mean, it, you know, we can't keep saying it's very, very sad, but because it is. But at the same time, there, and this is an interesting thing about, I think, the human psyche, there is something in it which does make people laugh a bit about it. And whether that's gallows humour or I don't know what it is, it's just, I think it's an interesting aspect to explore.
I think there are, for me, there are two key questions. So the first question is, why a star of that level? I mean, we're talking A plus, aren't we, really? Kind of A grade celebrity. Why he didn't have a satellite dish, I think, is probably the first question. Why he wasn't a Sky subscriber. And I think the second question, and I believe this is unknown, although I'll be interested to look at the coroner's report on this one, whether he was actually with Emu, whether Emu actually became a fatality as well during that incident.
It's not known if he was sporting Emu at the time. I suspect not, personally. I'd be very, very surprised if he was wearing Emu at the time. I mean, we can't rule it out because we don't know the facts, but I'd be extremely surprised if he was wearing Emu at the time. It's an interesting question.
So we could be looking at a kind of revenge crime, for example. You know, you might have got up onto the roof trying to, you know, adjust the picture and all that kind of stuff. Suddenly, Emu is upon him, you know. How dare you make me attack Michael Parkinson?
You forced me, Rod, over all those years to, you know, put my head up, you know, all sorts of places, which, you know, I was always against. And now I finally got you in a vulnerable position. You think Emu clamped around Rod's neck and actually threw him off the roof, even though he would have known, or she, that it would have meant their own demise as well. I mean, are you suggesting, James, this was a noble and selfless act of revenge?
It could have well been, and I can almost picture a kind of spinning camera image of Rod in the greenhouse with the emu laughing, knowing what had happened. Perhaps, you know, cackling almost. He never spoke, of course, the emu, but his final words could have been, "There's someone at the door. There's someone at the door."
It's the Grim Reaper, isn't it?
It could have been very spiritual, couldn't it? I think.
Well, I think that, James, in a brief nutshell, is Rod Hull's grave very enthusiastically trampled upon by you. I mean, I'm just the, you know, simple narrator of the facts. And I think that was an excellent place to start.
Hello there.
Hello.
I'm Jack Humphreys.
I'm Danny Denton.
And welcome to the Jack and Danny Show. This week, we've decided that we are going to Frankie.
That's right. We're going over the Channel to our French friends in French.
That's right.
Which is in Spain.
Now, Danny, as you know, you and I have studied for some weeks, or perhaps minutes, to get to grips with the language.
It's very important to converse properly with the foreigners, or John, as they like to be called mostly.
What we decided to do for you, listener, to help you out when you're in Frankie, is record one of our conversations that took place actually in a restaurante.
Now, I want to order, Jack, a bottle of that wine and stuff.
Well, I tell you what, Danny, it's very simple. Simply follow along with me. Garcon, Garcon, le bottle de l'eau minérale, vinesse.
And make sure it's proper brown ale in there.
Yes, if you'd like a different type of wine, there are three varieties. White or blanqué, as it is known.
Green or grenou.
Red, which is known as rogue.
And those are the three types of wine, mostly drunk in Spain, which is summer in France.
Excellent. Now, furthermore, we had some delicious dishes in Frankie, didn't we, Jackie?
That's right. I had a rather nice bowl of soup. Now, I wonder how I might order that again if I went to another restaurant.
It's very easy, Danny. It's simple as this. Je voudrais des potages dos lunin.
I say, John, over here. Yes, I'd like uno bowl, if you?
Bolos.
Bolos, thank you. Of dons le soup. Le nice soup avec le booze in it.
Now, I don't know about you, Danny, but I'm a big fan of seafood.
So am I, Jack.
And stuff. Frankie happens to be on the coast with the English Ocean.
Now, how would you order your favourite seafood?
Well, I'm glad you've asked that, because I'm a big fan of mackerel. And Thankfully, in Frankie, mackerel is very similar word. Macarellis.
Le Macarellis.
Le Macarellis. Or if you're feeling adventurous, Dos Macarellis Provençale.
I see a young waitress there. Let's have her over. Now, ahem, Doris, voulez-vous walkie over here, mes amis? I say that's knocked up bendy.
Now, we all like a bit of bread and a bit of water with our dinner, don't we?
And some booze.
Frankie goes mad and he has loads, and he often has it between courses.
Is that why they reek of garlic?
Quite possibly. Now, always remember, when ordering your water, there are two kinds. There is still water, known as Stylize,
and the other type of water, which is fizzy pop.
If you don't like fizzy pop, remember this helpful phrase, sans gaze.
And what's more, I'll tell you what I like with my soup and blue wine, and that's a nice cigarette.
Yes.
Now, tell me, what is a cigarette in this Frank language?
Well, Frankie is very, very keen on the cigarillo.
He loves cigarillos.
Yes. There are two main brands in Frankie, Tom Toms
and Blimbos.
Now,
I say, John, would voulez-vous come over here and light me up the Blimbo?
If you're looking to buy a packet of Blimbos, you might want to pop into a little kiosk, or a tarbuck, as they're known.
Here's one now. Excusez-moi, John. Je voudrais une bottle de Blimbo cigarillos. Jolly quick gracias, and then.
Yes, or, as I prefer, Tom Tom Blondes, a slightly lighter smoke.
You really are getting into the swing of things, aren't you, Jack?
I really am. Why not try and get in the swing of things with Frankie by joining in their national anthem, which I believe is about the Pope.
And garlic. And frogs.
Well, that's it for this week in our lovely adventure in Frankie. Join us next week when we go to Poly Portugal.
And join us the week after when we're going to Russia for the sun.
So we're going to move now to the obituary that I have chosen. And it's, as you said again at the beginning, it's really a celebration. And there are some, I have to say, some very poignant perhaps similarities in stories, actually, which is quite interesting. But see if you can identify who we're going to pay homage to with this obituary. So the actor in question that I'm talking about famously played Leslie Jackson in The Beatles' A Hard Day's Night, who I think you'll remember probably was a magician with some doves in that film, probably one of his leading roles. Originally born in Liverpool, 1930, he went on to take on a variety of roles, mainly sort of in the clergy and in the monastic profession, if we can call it that. But he also appeared in a Bond film, sort of, because he was in the spoof Casino Royale, which I think you'll remember David Niven limped through a long Indeed. Time ago. Yeah. Now, most people will remember this actor. This, I guess, a comedy actor. I wouldn't say his range extended far beyond that. Most people will remember him from BBC radio show Just a Minute, which has been going on just a century, I think, and from a sitcom called Oh Brother. I am, of course, talking about, I guess, one of my icons now. He's become that. I'm talking about Derek Robert Nimmo. So Derek Nimmo, is he someone on your radar, Dave?
Well, not massively. I mean, it's probably been weeks since I've read his biography in any great detail. Derek Nimmo, yeah, I do remember Derek Nimmo. Wasn't he in One of Our Dinosaurs Is Missing?
I think he did have a cameo in One of Our Dinosaurs Is Missing, yes.
As more than a cameo. Lord,
he was the Lord lead. Southmere, he was. I'm not sure he was the lead.
He was a posh spy, and his children and nanny got involved in recovering the dinosaur. I think you'll find he was integral to the plot, James. It was way more than a cameo.
I was just trying to brush over the fact I can't actually remember that film. But, you know, I'll dig it out. We'll work that bit in.
Yes, I do remember him. Yeah, I do. I mean, I think he was a big star, I think, in the 60s and 70s, really. So a long time before I was sort of conscious of it. But, you know, looking backwards, yeah. Okay, carry on. Yeah, very interesting. Derek Nimmo.
He started his life in national service, which was quite popular at the time, I think, in Cyprus, which obviously gave him exposure to a whole variety of cultures, shall we say, which obviously led him to become predominantly cast as a Christian priest. He was also a salesman for a paint company, and he worked in the insurance business as well. So these are all kind of natural sort of training grounds, aren't there, for actors at this kind of time, I suspect?
What, paint salesman and insurance? I guess it's part of weaving a life's rich tapestry, I suppose.
It exposes you to all sorts of people, I suppose, doesn't it? And I imagine that paint is a fascinating thing to have to try and sell.
I don't know about that. You said he started his life in national service. I'm not sure that's quite correct, because normally you do national service when you're about 18. So you may have meant something different.
I think he was allowed in early, I think, due to his... he was very tall.
Age zero.
Yeah, yeah. And you will remember, hopefully you will remember, that he became a household name in the 70s because of his association with a particular product. Can you remember what product that was?
No idea. Not a clue.
So he became the voice of the Penguin biscuit with Pippa Pick Up a Penguin.
Really? So, that was him, was it?
Yeah, so for the McVitie's biscuit company, he led that campaign, and obviously that led to all kinds of other work, predominantly going back to the sitcom that he was in previously in a different derivation called Oh Father.
I don't recall that, unfortunately, and that's probably a good thing. But that does remind me of something amusing about the supermarket Asda. I don't know if you remember. It's probably about 20 years ago. They got sued for successfully for marketing a number of items that possibly infringed on copyright of other retail places. And one of the things that they were sued for was that they had marketed a brand of chocolate-coloured biscuit called Pick Up a Pelican. The court was successfully persuaded. I think I'm right in saying, this is obviously, I'm not looking this up, I'm just remembering. The court was successfully persuaded that there was more than a passing similarity between Peppa Pick Up a Penguin and the Pelican reference, and they were ordered to stop doing it. There was something else about Parma ham, I think, but I could be wrong on that.
That was, I seem to remember you were offered quite a lucrative contract once on the Snaffle and Ocelot campaign, but I think that was stopped.
I've never refused a lucrative contract. Let's just be absolutely clear on that.
So coming back to Derek Nimmo, one of the other things you might not know about him was that he was quite a wine enthusiast. And in fact, this is a key factor in his demise, which we'll come on to shortly. But he was a bit of a wine expert, and he wrote several books on wine and obviously drinking wine and drinking too much wine.
Whilst heavily inebriated throughout. Which is the only way to write.
And he also wrote books on the theatre, because he was a bit of a lovey, I suspect. I loved the treading the boards.
The image I have of him is something of a theatre impresario. I've got a feeling he may have been involved in sort of production as well as performance and things like that, but I'm not really sure.
He did get involved in theatre. I'm not sure if he directed anything. He probably sort of just dabbled in a bit of Amdram, like we all have, to make... ends meet. But he was quite also a prolific after-dinner speaker. Now, this is quite a lucrative market, I think, particularly for sitcom stars and comedians. I don't know if Rod Hull ever went down that route. I imagine he would have smashed up the glasses and everything if he, before he even got to making a speech. But I think the thing that people liked about Derek Nimmo was that he had that authority. You know, he was very believable as a vicar or a priest or a bishop, even though he had never sort of served in those kind of roles, sort of formally. But he was very credible. He became the very, the very knowledgeable, sort of almost stoic authority figure.
Do you think he used to do after dinner speaking dressed up in the priest's garb with the priest clothing and the dog collar and everything?
I think it's highly likely. I think it would have depends on the gig, doesn't it, what they ask you to wear. I know when I do them, there's a certain refusal list that I have.
You want to go dressed as the devil with those horns on, and I in a lot of circumstances, that is, for the ladies' Christmas lunch, that's, maybe not super suitable.
Indeed not. Now, also, people also link Derek Nimmo to another icon, which I guess he is an icon, but we don't probably... think too much about him. But if you think about the board game Cluedo, which I'm sure you've played, which is a kind of murder mystery board game, isn't it?
A detestable game. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you imagine which character Derek Nimmo may have played in the 1975 film of that name? Well,
as a wild shot in the dark, I'm guessing he played Reverend Green. Was it?
I think you're spot on. But for an extra 100 marks, there. Do you know what his first name is?
Claudius.
Very close. It was actually Jonathan. So he did play the Reverend Jonathan Green. It was a TV production, Cluedo, which I can't remember ever seeing, to be honest. But I imagine some of the other cast were probably Rula Lenska, Dennis Waterman, Donna Stell was probably in there.
Yes, that's. I can imagine the 70s celebs, you know, cramming that one in. Did you? The name Jonathan itself has a religious connotation. Did you know that?
Is that right? I didn't know that.
I believe it comes from, it's Latin, Ionos Thanos, which means gift of God. So there you go. There's an obvious connection there for a clergyman.
I'm going to write that down because next time I'm asked to give an after dinner speech, you know, in the next sort of 5 to 15 years, I will wedge that in there, I think.
I think you should. I think you should. As much cod Latin as you can get in is bound to impress the punters.
Get it in there. So we're gonna move to the demise. And again, this, as you were sort of outlining earlier on, this isn't to make light of this, not in any way at all. And I think it's to explore some of the perhaps comedic aspects of how he went. You know, the way he went. So
can I just ask? There must be a reason why you've picked somebody as relatively obscure as Derek Nimmer. And I'm just hoping. Is hoping the right word? I suspect that he must have gone out in a pretty spectacular way for you to have led us down this particular path. Would I be right in thinking that? You're going to tell us, so we don't need to speculate. Go on, you carry on.
I think you're very near the number on this one.
I thought I might be.
In many ways, this obituary, I think, sparked this podcast. This was the originator. So, again, I've bigged it up too much there. So we'll press on with the circumstances. So on the 2nd of December, 1998, Derek Nimmer attended the National Treasures Celebrity Lunch in the boardroom of the Daily Express. It says newspaper here, but I don't think that's right. Tattle rag. Along with Sir Peter O'Sullivan, Joan Collins, Dame Beryl Bainbridge, Dickie Davis was there.
Royalty. Showbiz royalty.
And Sue McGregor was there as well. So, I mean, you know, imagine going to some kind of function with Dickie Davis.
Okay.
I mean,
royalty and some minor members of the court.
It was absolutely, you know, a stellar showing from everywhere, everyone there. So, you know, I mean, what a cast of people to be asked to a lunch with. And certainly by the Daily Express. I mean, you know, I'd have been around there a little bit later.
You weren't there at the time.
I wasn't invited, unfortunately. So anyway, Derek had just come back touring in the Middle East, Run for Your Wife.
Oh yeah.
Which is an ongoing farce, isn't it? I think quite apt really for this. After lunch, I think he was quite well lunched. He decided, like many of us do after we've had pork pie and some crisps and all those kind of things, particularly when Joan Collins is involved as well, because she does A, like to put it away, and B, like to get it out. But we'll talk about that in another podcast in the future. He asked to go to the Garrick Club, you and I are obviously there fairly often these days.
Many times I've been down the street that it's on. So, you know, you can't claim closer association than that.
Well, I've seen you disgracing yourself in the doorway. But again, we'll talk about that another.
Reasons were medical.
Oh, okay. So he went there for, just an after party drink, you know, after drinks party drink, I think.
Sure.
Yes. And again, remember the wine connection here. He was probably doing some research for a new book.
One of his interminable books, yeah.
And when they got home, where he lived, somewhere in Kensington, I think, he decided that he probably was still a bit hungry because, after 3 to 4 litres of wine, he was, you know, he was feeling the munchies, you might call them. Any students listening, you know, might call it that. So he decided to take his wife out to dinner, and he must have been charming company, mustn't he? By
of course,
after an all afternoon session.
Think of the anecdote.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, you know, they could have booked him, couldn't they, for one of his after dinners? So they went out for a big lavish dinner on top of the National Treasure celebrity lunch that he'd already had. When they got home, there was a bit of concern in the household because the alarm, the burglar alarm wasn't working properly, and the external alarm to the house was making a kind of strange noise, or it had gone off, or it was had been triggered. So Derek, being a little bit worse for wear, decided that he'd try and fix it himself, because why wouldn't you, of course?
Why wouldn't you?
So he climbed up partly up the side of the house.
I'm starting to sense now an element of danger. Okay, I'm just starting to get a lot of people will not have picked up on this yet, but I'm starting to get a hint that some event is about to. So he's climbing up the side of the house. Okay, go on. Yep.
Yeah, he's kind of mid balustrade. You know, he's kind of up the support rail of a stone from stone steps at the back of the property, probably flailing around a little. He's probably trying to overreach himself a little bit.
Stick to the facts. You're embroidering this beyond what we know for sure.
So he, unbelievably, even though you know he's very focused and he's a very precise alarms engineer, he slips and he falls down a stone staircase straight into the basement of his house. And again, it gets a bit serious here, where he suffered a number of head injuries, and he ended up in Chelsea and Westminster Hospital. And sadly, a couple of months later, died of his injuries and of pneumonia.
A couple of months later?
Yeah, it took him a while to go, I think. Partly because he was pickled.
Indeed. It is a known preservative. Well, I am shocked and appalled. That is an extremely nasty way to go, and I feel tremendous sympathy for him and his family.
The summary of it, though, is he had a massive lunch and drinks with Joan Collins and Dickie Davis, went home via his club and some more drinks, decided at the spur of the moment to take his wife out for dinner and more drinks, came home, shouted at the fire alarm, and fell over the stairs into the basement. There has to be an element of comedy about that, doesn't there?
There is a hint towards the slapstick, like all tragic, you know, falls from heights, which we seem to have focused on heavily in this episode. There is a hint of there is a hint of pathos in it, isn't there? Do you think that as an old showbiz ledge, having been out on a massive beano with loads of celebs, been to his club, gone out for dinner, that maybe that's kind of the way he would have wanted to have checked out? I mean, not necessarily with the huge head trauma and 2 months in a coma or whatever, but just, you know, the kind of broad shape of the day. You know, if you're gonna, you know, on the day that your number is up, you know, there are worse ways than that to finish things off.
A sudden, violent, drunken, casual death is what you're kind of suggesting you wished for.
You're focusing on all the wrong elements there, James. I mean, almost as if that was deliberate. If you're designing your final day, then, you know, lunch with Joan Collins, trip to the Garrick Club, out for another gigantic dinner, write a couple of books on wine that nobody wants to read, and then falling off the roof. I mean, it's textbook, isn't it?
I guess. I mean, there is an element here where he could have been, you know, in some kind of the heightened state of spiritual reconciliation after meeting Dickie Davis. Because I know, certainly I've read Dickie Davis had some sort of mind-altering, mesmerizing power that he deducted from his from that white streak in his hair, I think, during the sports scores.
That's right. That is well known that he divined pretty potent powers through that hairpiece. He was well known for that, I think. I don't know whether it's hypnosis or something purely magical. We'll have to speculate on that, to be honest. I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know if Dickie Davis is still with us or whether he ought to feature as a future subject of this this scientific investigation which we're recording. Maybe that's something to think about. But maybe
I will look.
Our team of editors and researchers could focus on that for maybe a future episode.
I will look that up because I've recently got his autobiography out of the local library called They All Love a Bit of Dickie, apparently. So I'm going to read that and check some of those facts. But Derek Nimmo there, sadly demised in another set of comedic circumstances.
That's just the way he went. Name?
Roger Bulsara.
Okay, let's just
start again.
Name?
Roger Bulsara.
You can't do that. Okay, right.
I'm getting in character.
You're not going to break me. You're not going to break me. I'm thinking of sad things now. That's why I asked about my motivation. Okay. Right. Here we go. You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay, no laughing this time.